welcome to Love is the Message, a podcast about music, the dance floor, sound systems and counterculture. I'm Jeremy Gilbert. I'm here as usual with my friend Tim Lawrence. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Jem.
And today, as we are drawing towards the close of our series on New York,
have you not been listening?
72, 75?
90.
I have.
Oh, Jeremy. Goodness.
It's been so long, I can't remember when we started. It feels like we started in 1822.
So 1975 to 1976.
It's just 75 to 76. I can't believe we've spent this long on 2 years. And we are going to talk about the birth, or perhaps the pre-birth, of hip-hop. We're talking about the proto-hip-hop music and scene of the period. And Tim's going to really lead us through some of the key historical events and figures. And we'll be talking about them as they come up. So, Tim, I mean, firstly, where does the name hip-hop even come from? And when can it be identified as emerging as a thing?
Yeah, well, good question, and I'll come up with a controversial answer, and I'll say that most histories of hip hop will say that hip hop was born, and will describe hip hop as being born with the name hip hop in 1973, when DJ Kool Herc, who we'll come back to, started to put on parties in the Rec Center, in the place where he was living in Cedric Avenue. But actually, hip hop doesn't come into circulation as a term that actually references the four elements. The four elements being DJing, MCing, graffiti, and breaking. It doesn't come into circulation as a term until basically 1981. This is quite a big. There's quite a big gap, of course, between 1973 and 1981. We're going to come back to how this comes about at some point in the next 10 years or something, when we finally get to 1981. But the immediate, just to sort of flag up the, I guess we could say the immediate, the most obvious kind of development that led to the emergence of the term hip hop was when Fab Five Freddy, Fred Brathwaite, got together with Charlie Ahern to make Wild Style, which was going to start out to be a film about graffiti. But then Fred Brathwaite, who was hanging out in the downtown scene, including at places like CBGB, which were full of people who were sort of, pretty conceptual and theoretical and, thinking through this culture. Fred Brathwaite was going there, and it occurred to him that, actually, it would be more interesting to frame graffiti as being part of a wider subculture that included elements of dance and other things. And so, in the end, Wild Style became this movie that wasn't just about breaking, but was also about DJing and MCing. And, a few months later, through the kind of contributions of, amongst other people, actually Malcolm McLaren, but also Michael Holman, who was kind of involved with, this sort of punk scene, but also the breaking scene, started to put on a show. For I think it was it Bow Wow Wow, one of Malcolm McLaren's artists and
groups. They were bands.
Yeah, bands. I mean, artists. Yeah, band. And it was Michael Holman who took Malcolm McLaren up to see Afrika Bambaataa DJing in the Bronx, and Malcolm McLaren was blown away, and then asked Michael Holman to kind of put something on as the warm up for a Bow Wow Wow performance at this live venue called the Ritz. And Michael Holman put together not just DJing and MCing that was sort of from the Bronx, but also some breaking and some graffiti. And this was the first time that these four elements came together. Previously, graffiti was really quite separate. It's not to say that graffiti wasn't happening, but it just wasn't part of the dance scene. Graffiti was something that basically happened on the subway, on the depots, where the train depots at night. It wasn't something that was kind of part of, DJ culture and MC culture.
Yeah, and Jesse Jarno says graffiti begins with the kind of the Central Park hippie scene.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know. What year is that then? Is it the mid-60s, basically?
No, or very early 70s.
Definitely it goes back to the mid-60s. And then there's a Greek graffiti artist called Taki, I think his name is, who's, I think, is maybe early 70s. But yeah, it has all these roots, and you know, you can actually trace graffiti back through history. You know, it's like painting, it's like, you know, art on a wall, basically. You know, it does have long, deep roots, including going back sort of, you know, Egyptian hieroglyphics and even cave painting, if you like. So look, these are complex histories, but the idea, you know, what tends to happen, and look, what I want to say is that, I mean, this is one of my kind of, you know, if you like, arguments or theories. It was a big thing for me in the last book. You and I, Jem, grew up in an age, whether it was the late 80s or the 1990s, where there was a sense that, you know, dance music culture, primarily in the form of house music, and rap culture and rock culture were quite antagonistic. And whilst rock and rap could sometimes get together and form alliances, you know, to a certain extent, they were always oppositional to house music culture. You know, and that was a particular historical moment that came off the back of the mid-1980s, when all of these cultures were basically very antagonistic to each other. But what I argue is, if you flip back to the 1970s, these cultures, in particular, let's say hip hop and, for want of a better term, disco, they didn't even have a name. People didn't even know what they would be antagonistic about necessarily. These scenes weren't necessarily even meeting each other. They had no profile. And so, you know, I'm really trying to argue with hip hop is what I've already argued with disco, is that people think it was born whole, let's say at the beginning of 1970 with disco, or in 1973 with hip hop, but they weren't. What was happening is communities were coming together in different parts of New York City and were organizing around music that they found to be exciting and was a great way of bringing people together, which, as we know, is you know, it works. And in many ways, these cultures had shared far more in common than distinguished them. And there was no clear-cut distinction, or even if there were differences between what was going on. So it's just really just unpicking some of these historical assumptions, which have sort of been superimposed from the future to the past, and just saying, well, what was going on? And yeah, what was going on is that, you know, a certain form of, you know, culture took root in Bronx, which was different to what was going on in the downtown scene, let's say, in 1973. But it was by no means completely different, because basically these were DJ-led cultures, which, you know, were paying a lot of attention to sound systems and were largely driven by kind of funky music, as was, you know, and soul music and music that had breaks and music that basically wanted people to dance. So it's kind of, so it's about, you know, just recognizing this really, and seeing what some of the implications are. And for me, the implications are that we have, you know, human beings have more in common than we're sometimes led to believe.
Well, there's also a whole fascinating question always about what kind of a cultural or discursive or social phenomenon hip-hop is. It's always interesting to talk to students about this, because hip-hop in some ways exemplifies a set of tendencies, or rather the way we talk and think about hip-hop, the way it gets talked about and thought about publicly in various kinds of media from the early 80s onwards. They exemplify a tendency, or a set of tendencies, that a certain strain of cultural analyst has been pointing to since the end of the 60s, according to which, on the one hand, you might have various groups of often young people doing very interesting things culturally, musically, but there's a sort of desire, often on the part of, say, both journalists and some of the people involved in those activities, to really kind of overstate the extent to which somehow being engaged in those cultural activities defines the whole social identity of the people who are involved in them, and defines them as completely separate, having a completely separate social identity from people who aren't. So, I mean, it's actually in the UK, this is the first identified example of this, because that's the classic work of like media sociology and cultural sociology, Stan Cohen's book, Folk Devils and Moral Panics, which introduced the term moral panic to social theory. It's about media panics, about the supposed, you know, rivalry and violent fights between mods and rockers on the English South Coast beaches in the mid-60s. And most of Cohen's thesis is that most of this is sort of made up, that there are groups of young people who you can identify as having distinctive musical tastes and styles and a vague sort of social rivalry. But the idea that there's this really coherent, tight, easily identifiable, completely defined culture of mods and an equivalent one of rockers and they hate each other and define themselves against each other and are fighting each other is sort of 90% a fantasy of some of the people involved, who are mostly just people doing quite ordinary jobs, 90% of their lives, and living quite ordinary lives, and of the journalists writing about them. And then there's always this very complex dialectic with hip-hop culture between, you know, the idea of it being this completely coherent, identifiable way of life, which revolves around these four cultural practices and begins in the Bronx. And then it's not clear. The narrative always starts to break down at the point where you try to explain, well, how did it become like a trendy thing to do for like middle class people in France, like by the 1990s? Like, what? How did that happen? And how does that relate to the idea of it as somehow a kind of authentic expression of the unique street culture of a part of a New York borough in the 1970s? I mean, that's not really something we're going to track here at all.
But it's a good question, and it'll be fun when we do get to do it.
Yeah, but it's always a really fascinating thing because, you know, it's obvious that you can't, the idea of hip hop as this tightly definable subculture cannot explain at all how it becomes globally popular, because it doesn't really explain why anybody outside the Bronx ever became interested in it. And then, of course, by the time you get into the 90s and you get into this incredible process of people coming from quite middle class backgrounds, like deciding they've got to be involved in gang violence in order to justify their status as hip hop stars, and just sort of the story of people like Tupac. And well, the only thing to be said at this point is sort of from the beginning, there's a process of both really intense cultural innovation, but then also almost feverish myth making about that innovation and what it means. And part of the mythologizing is always, and you know, what Lukács would call the reifying of it, is this fantasy that somehow the people involved in these things are these sort of style tribes who are engaged in a contest with others. Of course, McLaren's really interesting here, because Malcolm McLaren, you can see Malcolm McLaren as a really key cultural figure, because basically he is one of the first people from the early 70s onwards as a cultural entrepreneur to get the idea that what you want to do is, you don't want to do what they did in the 60s and tell everybody and tell audiences and consumers that you're going to be like everyone else by liking the thing you're liking. That this is the new hip thing, whether it's the Beatles or the Twist or surf music, that everyone's doing it, so you should do it. McLaren's one of the first people to realize that in the era of incipient post-Fordism, what you want to do is tell people this is how to be different. This is how to be ahead of the curve. This is how to be distinctive from your friends and neighbors. And he sort of does that with punk. And then when punk becomes sort of too popular and too political, he loses interest in it. And then he tries to do it with sort of very nascent hip hop, and he's trying to do it.
And before hip hop, it's Adam and the Ants and Bow Wow Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
It's this sort of, you know, pirate, you know, African aesthetic almost heavily.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, heavily on Burundi culture, I think.
Exactly, and you can see it in terms of the stuff we've said on the show lots of times now about Fordism and post-Fordism. And from a really crude perspective, he's someone who's really got his ear to the ground. He really understands the implications of post-Fordism, and he's trying to ride that wave. And so he's sort of, it does, I think it's a really good point you've made, that it leads to a kind of mythology which tries to promote the idea of a kind of cultural fragmentation. It tries to promote cultural fragmentation and social fragmentation, where actually, you know, the context it's coming from are more context of, you know, social solidarity and forms of cooperation and intermixture and cultural contact.
Well, the point is, there's nothing wrong with post-Fordism per se. It's like, you know, as we've sort of argued before on this show, I mean, not between ourselves, you know, post-Fordism was the birth of something that was really quite promising initially. It was, you know, it enabled greater freedom, it enabled new forms of collectivity, new forms of expression, versus the, you know, the stratification and hierarchies of, you know, much of the 20th century and in particular the post-war era. I mean, the problem is when, you know, being, let's say, distinctive implies some sort of, you know, let's say, codified separation or hostility. I mean, we there's nothing wrong with variety. The problem is only when that variety leads to a sense of, you know, sense of tribal conflict, if you like. You know, in a sense, I think that Malcolm McLaren was onto something that was quite positive, that people want to find ways to, you know, have a sense that they're expressing something that's meaningful. The problem partly comes when, you know, the mode with which you do that is a mythology that suggests distinction and hostility. So you read these hip hop histories and, you know, most of them are written by people I admire and, you know, I'm friends with a whole bunch of them. And there's a mythology that, you know, it's hip hop was basically different from and hostile to disco and disco culture. And it very soon plays into in the mid 1980s, late 1980s and the early 1990s. I mean, I think Nelson George's Death of Rhythm and Blues, which is a book we both know fairly well, is one of the first books to kind of do this, basically says, you know, the disco did basically suck because it whitened and commercialized black culture. Now, you could take a certain strand of disco, whether it be the Bee Gees or whether it be aspects of Euro disco, and you can say that's quite right. But you, in order to do that, you've got to kind of erase the entire contribution of black musicians to disco. And, you know, there's no reason to do that. It's actually a negative point. You know, why was Nelson George doing this? Well, he was starting to write these books in the, you know, late 1980s, when, thanks to Reaganism, you know, neoconservatism, which would soon mutate into neoliberalism, rising levels of racism that were connected to the crack epidemic and you know, media fabrications about black criminality and the homophobia that became rampant in light of the AIDS epidemic, all of a sudden we live in a world of conflict. And, you know, everyone within this setting, I mean, this is part of the conclusion of the last book, everyone within this setting having been actually largely approaching the world with open arms and an open heart, willing to see what kind of connections could be made, suddenly becomes defensive and the arms become closed and you see everyone as a possible antagonist. And we, you know, we all know about the hostility that kind of emerged between the black community and the gay community, with black gay people sort of trapped in the middle. You know, one, you know, the black community was alleging that the gay community was apolitical and didn't care about racism and class inequality. And the gay community was saying the black community was homophobic. These are generalizations, of course, and they're not even true as such. But there were aspects in which just the social and economic milieu of this kind of very conflictual moment, you know, instilled them with a certain truth. And it was in this moment that some of these histories, in particular around hip hop, came to be born. And, you know, I've spent quite a lot of time trying to unpick them. And what's interesting on some level is that I think clearly the world has moved on. We have a whole different set of, not a whole set of different, but, you know, maybe interconnected and evolved problems today. But the one thing we don't quite so clearly have is like a natural sense of antagonism and hostility between these music cultures. You know, there's a lot more fluidity and openness, you know, but there's a lot, you know, I've lost track of the number of queer hip hop artists we now have, for example, and that would have been unimaginable in the mid 1980s and late 1980s.
Yeah, it's a good point.
So this is part of the context. And I did expect actually to, you know, get quite a lot of hostility or opposition to these the arguments when I published them in the last book, and I've sort of been, you know, making them as I've been going around. And that just simply hasn't been the case. I mean, I'm not trying to say, oh, I was right. Maybe there's a certain truth to some of this anyway.
I think you're right. Okay.
Good.
So let's
good. Start. I'm glad you say that.
Love is the message.
We're really grateful for everybody who's listening. We're also really grateful for the support we've been getting from patrons. And if you'd like to become one of them, you can easily sign up at patreon.com. There'll be a link in the notes. And if you do that, then you get the benefit of not listening to any more of these begging messages. We've been really pleased with the support the show's been getting so far. We're basically on track to sort of keep meeting our target of making it viable. But at the same time, you know, it has turned into a project, which I think is probably more satisfying than we expected, but also more work than we expected. It's turning into, I think, a sort of unique intellectual endeavor, really, this podcast. So if you can support it, we'd really be grateful. If you can't, don't worry. Keep listening. The standard history of hip hop that everybody knows begins with Kool Herc and then the activities of African Bambaataa and Grandmaster Flash. So why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Herc was born in Jamaica in 1955. And in 1967, we've obviously covered this in earlier episodes, in some deep, not Herc, but Jamaican music culture in the 60s and early 70s. And if any listeners have not listened to those episodes in detail and memorized them, then of course that's what we recommend they go back and do. But by 1967, Herc had moved to New York City. These are pretty early years within the evolution of ska to reggae culture. It's, you know, and we've yet to really even get dub music coming through properly at this particular point, which is interesting. And I'll come back to this in just a moment. But anyway, yeah, Herc moved with his family to New York City in 1967. But 6 years later, so he is, by the time he is actually 16, sorry, not 16. That did seem ridiculously young. He's 18. Yes. In the Rec Room in Cedric Avenue in August 1973. And he pulls together a sound system, which soon becomes one of the, you know, most powerful, monstrous sound systems of the South Bronx. And he DJs and he does some MCing as well, which, you know, we have good reason to think could be rooted in Jamaican culture, except that, you know, forms of rapping and MCing also have a very long history in the United States as well, as we've also discussed in previous episodes when we were looking at the rise of MC culture, not only in Jamaica, but also in the United States. So anyway, he puts on these parties and this becomes, and there's some elements of like, a couple of dancers start to do something which is akin to breaking, and we can come back to this a bit later, at these parties. And this is kind of understood to be kind of, you know, the birth moment of hip hop. So what in my sense is going on here is, well, it's what's going on here is what's going on some level all over New York City, in particular in the Bronx, but also in Brooklyn. There's a very evolved culture of mobile DJing with DJs like Maboya and Flowers. Many guys who actually very soon will, in 1975, join the record pool that's formed by David Mancuso and Steve DeCristo. These guys are operating in the Bronx and they're putting on regular parties and they have mobile sound systems. And what we can say is distinctive about Herc is he soon develops his sound system to be the most powerful of all. And we might want to say that, well, you know, that this was a particularly developed culture in Jamaica. Whether we can sort of safely say that Herc gets this idea because of the first 12 years he spent in Jamaica is a little bit hard to say. I'm not sure that that's kind of been established. I'm also not trying to say that there isn't any kind of connection at all with whatever Herc experienced as he grew up in the first 12 years of his life in Jamaica. But all I'm trying to say is that something which is seen to be distinctive is actually something which is already going on with you know, a bunch of other kind of DJs and basically party organizers all over the city. And of course, we also know that DJ-led dance floor culture had already, you know, taken root in downtown New York and also with Francis Grasso in the western part of west side of Midtown in the meatpacking, in Hell's Kitchen 3.5 years earlier. I'm not knocking this. I'm just saying, yeah, that New York City was, you know, living and breathing and oozing DJ culture at this particular moment. If you know, one of the most respected history of hip hop pretty much is Jeff Chang's Can't Stop, Won't Stop. And, you know, Jeff Chang sort of identified, and I like, you know, Jeff is, it's a great book and I love Jeff and he's a really brilliant writer, but there's sections in this which sort of say, you know, which basically make the assumption that this only happened in 1973 in the Bronx because Herc was from Jamaica. And it sort of attributes, it says that hip hop roots basically are black and Jamaican. You know, my argument would be, well, they might be a part of that, but basically they're overwhelmingly New York because this sound system culture is happening everywhere. I mean, one of the ways that this kind of argument gets to sort of be developed is that, and David Toop, our, you know, very esteemed kind of colleague, you know, one of the great writers of, you know, of music and, you know, a really, you know, amazing musician as well in his own right, an improviser. David Toop, who's, you know, very eclectic and open-minded, and wrote great stuff about, you know, at, you know, defining, you know, early book about, you know, Ocean of Sound, about ambient music, and also published the first book about rap music called Rap Attack. Both David Toop and Jeff Chang sort of say, yeah, you know, the thing was that Herc basically started these parties with the aim of basically playing dub music. And reggae music, it kind of reinforces on some level this idea that really the roots of hip hop can be found in Jamaican reggae and dub culture. But, you know, it was in researching. And look, there's some credibility to this, except that while researching the last book, I came across some, you know, pretty early interview with Herc, a guy called Stephen Hagger, who wrote another early, basically, history of hip-hop that came out shortly after David Toop's, interviewed Herc about, you know, what was going on at the party. And Herc was like, well, actually, his bag was packed full of funk records. So there was never necessarily an intention to kind of just play sort of dub reggae music. So I haven't really explained this particularly well, because how the story goes, well, I've explained it okay, but I missed a bit out. The story for Jeff Chang and David Toop goes, yeah, the idea, he wanted to play dub reggae music, but it didn't go down well. And it was when it didn't go down well, and as Herc realized it wasn't going down well, that he decided he had to respond to the energy on the dance floor, which was to basically take it up tempo and start. And then he started to play funk music. But as anyone knows who's ever DJing, you kind of, you know, it's different maybe in the digital age today, but, you know, in the physical analog age, you had to pack your records before you went to the turntables. And in Herc's bag were all of these funk records. And that was always intention. And so what were the records that he was basically kind of, wanted to play at this party before he even played it? He knew in advance that his peak records were going to be Rare Earth's Get Ready, which we know was being played by everyone, including Francis Grasso and David Bancuso, already for a few years. And the other key record he had in his bag was the live version of James Brown's Give It Up or Turn It Loose. So, let's actually just hear. Why don't we hear? We've heard James Brown's Give It Up or Turn It Loose, you know, a few times, and I'm not sure we've listened to Rare Earth's Get Ready yet. So let's have a listen to that track. So this is just an amazing record that lasts the whole side of an album, you know, and it was being played, you know, all over New York City. And what it suggests is that, you know, it's not that Herc came from a Jamaican background and a Jamaican mentality that meant that he was going to be basically playing reggae and dub music all night. And then, to his consternation, people didn't like it. And that's when he picked up the funk. And that's what led to hip hop. So it's kind of a process of Jamaican culture feeding through black culture, leading to hip hop. You know, instead, what we can see is that Herc, like, you know, everyone who wanted to play records to a dance crowd at this particular historical moment, whether they were in the Bronx or whether they were downtown, were drawing on the same set of records and playing to crowds that wanted up-tempo funky music. It was about connection and commonality, not about, like, distinctiveness. So this is kind of one of the things that's going on in this particular moment. I mean, what we can say about Herc, and I've sort of gestured to this, is he'd had this developed sound system. He developed these mighty twin speakers, which were called the Herculoids, or is it the Herc? And they were helped by, I think it's the Herculoids.
Do we know when he started calling himself Herc? Because that's obviously not his given name. His name's Clive Campbell.
Exactly, yeah. I don't know, actually. That's a good question. I think it's very early on, if not right from the beginning. I mean, the thing about Herc is it becomes big very quickly. He's got a great taste in funk-oriented music. He develops a big sound system. I mean, one thing I think... Well, I was going to... Let's touch on this also. He brings... this element of rapping and emceeing into what he's doing. And this is also seen to be a distinctive feature. But, you know, there is this kind of history of emceeing and rapping that just has a very long history and trajectory in the United States. I mean, some people like to say, for example, I mean, one thing is there's someone like, you know, there's Eddie Cheever and DJ Hollywood, who are mobile DJs, who are already basically talking over the mic as they play records. We could say, and many people do like to say, that basically Muhammad Ali was a rapper, you know, the way he would kind of, you know, talk to the media as he about his opponent as he was kind of preparing for a fight.
Yeah, there's the talking blues as well.
Yeah, exactly. The most influential black DJ on New York radio, Frankie Crocker, who was a DJ at WBLS, I forget what his nickname was, but basically he was a smooth talker, and he was constantly kind of basically rapping over records in order to just kind of, you know, talk the talk and entertain, actually. And, you know, and then we have, you know, well, I think we should listen to this. You know, we have Gil Scott-Heron, you know, mutating funk artists who bring in jazz and soul and are crossing the boundaries of black music of the day, recording tracks such as The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.
On the rare earth, the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will
Well, yeah, well, I mean, it's a classic. I mean, it's often mentioned alongside contemporary recordings by the Lost Poets, who were really coming out of the jazz poetry, the beat poetry scene, which is another big influence, actually, arguably, certainly an influence on people like Gil Scott-Heron, that there's this practice since the 50s of people reciting, I mean, formal poetry over jazz music. And as jazz and funk converge within certain contexts, you start to get a sound from people like Gil Scott-Heron and the Lost Poets that is arguably retrospectively recognisable as, again, a sort of proto-hip-hop. And arguably that sort of jazzy hip-hop is a strand that runs all the way through hip-hop itself and is always a component of hip-hop culture and, to some extent, a distinctive one. We could hear the Lost Poets' 1971 track, When the Revolution Comes. Very good example of a sort of very percussive beat poetry. You can sort of see as another kind of proto-hip-hop.
Put that nod and wake up when the revolution comes. When the revolution comes, transit cops will be crushed by the trains after losing their guns. And blood will run through the streets of Harlem, drowning anything without substance. When the revolution comes. When the revolution comes. When the revolution comes,
when the revolution comes,
I hope pearly white teeth fall out of the mouths that speak of revolution without reference. The course of revolution is 360 degrees. Understand the cycle that never ends. Understand the beginning to be the end, and nothing is in between but space.
And yeah, and obviously, I mean, Gil Scott-Heron, I'm sure people listening will mostly be familiar with Gil Scott-Heron, but he is a very important figure in that he really is, he's arguably the person whose music and lyrics sort of fulfill the promise of funk as the soundtrack to black radicalism in the 70s. Extremely, incredibly articulate, incredibly politically sophisticated, also sort of producing and exemplifying just in the performance a kind of aesthetic of articulacy, a sort of aesthetic of verbal dexterity and intelligence that is going to become associated with hip-hop, especially in the 80s, in a way which is really interesting, I think. And, I mean, this is obviously a really classic bit of music.
Yeah. So, again, it's to really situate this culture not as being something that is born whole and is entirely distinctive, but is something which is connecting to other cultural developments and is really about, a relatively... I don't want to say slow, maybe it was even quite rapid, but it's about convergence. It's about bringing existing elements and tapping into them and, you know, and through your appreciation of them, repeating them, sometimes in different combinations, which is almost kind of inevitable on some sort of level. I mean, it's, you know, Herc does emerge as a really significant figure, but what he is a really significant, you know, DJ who's basically doing what a bunch of other DJs are doing in the Bronx, you know, DJing, getting together a sound system, talking over music, and just kind of does it to a level which, you know, thrills dancers more and becomes the, you know, rightly a person who, I mean, because he went on to influence so many other people, has a major, is seen to be a major historical figure in his own right. But this is something that's kind of, you know, but the idea that this is distinctive and is as hip hop is something which is somewhat imposed, you know, from the future in order to create a kind of a mythological narrative, which is not harmful in and of itself, but sometimes can kind of, you know, mask kind of some of the commonalities of what's going on throughout the city. So anyway, just to kind of bring this, to move the story forward a little bit, you know, Herc by the summer of 1974 starts to do this thing which goes on to again get kind of seen to be of, you know, remarkable historical significance, and in some ways it is, which is he starts to mix between the breaks. And this technique becomes known as the merry-go-round. And as Jeff Chang puts it, and he interviews and quotes Cool Herc on this, so I'll just read a little bit of a quote because why not? Herc told Jeff Chang, "I was smoking cigarettes and I was waiting for the records to finish, and I noticed people was waiting for certain parts of the record." Jeff Chang goes on to say, "It was an insight as profound as Ruddy Redwood's dub discovery. The moment when the dancers really got wild was in a song's short instrumental break, when the band would drop out and the rhythm section would get elemental. Forget melody, chorus songs. It was all about the groove, building it, keeping it going. Like a string theorist, Herc zeroed in on the fundamental vibrating loop at the heart of the record, the break." I mean, an old good friend of mine who I'm sadly lost touch with a bit, called Garnett Cardigan, who, you know, also I believe is Caribbean anyway. I think he might be a Jamaican. Basically makes a similar kind of, you know, argument, and sort of says, yeah, it's because of Herc's upbringing in Jamaica, and because dub musicians were, you know, putting together these kind of mixes in the studio, that he was pre-programmed to kind of think that you could cut up and chop up elements of music in order to create a new piece of music. On some sort of historical level, you know, Herc had left, was only a 12-year-old and left Jamaica probably, I think it's 6 years maybe before dub music comes through. So this might, you know, whether that's kind of, you know, even historically possible is somewhat open to question. But the more important point, I think, is just to sort of note that, you know, for whatever Herc might have done it, the idea that you would mix together two records and maybe interrupt records and take segments of those records and connect them was something that was just going on. It was widespread by this point in New York City. It was actually made, it's possible that this technique first emerged in Boston, somewhat bizarrely, around 1973, maybe early 1974. We do know that it's pretty much simultaneously, and we've said this on an earlier show, I'm pretty sure, or at least I did in a Patrons episode, that Walter Gibbons was also doing the same tech, performing the same technique, but with far more precision than Herc was doing in terms of isolating the break and extending it. In fact, one of the things that and I'm not trying to really create a hierarchy here, but it's just something as a matter of fact, really, is that Herc was notoriously imprecise when he was mixing between the breaks. There was no precise scientific kind of lining up so that there was this sort of seamless kind of mixing between the breaks. Whereas we do know that Walter Gibbons, right from the start, and it's true of a bunch of these Boston DJs and also David Todd in Philadelphia, but in particular Walter Gibbons, was doing it with remarkable precision. And we also know that Nicky Ciano was, I mean, aside from the fact that there was loads of mixing was already going on in this sort of the DJ, the wider DJ scene in New York City, and in particular the downtown scene, that Nicky Ciano in particular, from around, you know, the summer of 1973 onwards, so again, a sort of a year earlier, is also interrupting records in order to, you know, introduce different kind of levels of mixing and reconceptualizing records as they're moving along. I mean, someone like David Mancuso, and we know DJs like Francis Grasso objected to this. They thought you shouldn't interrupt the record. You shouldn't interfere with the musician's intent. But they weren't, you know, but there were lots of DJs who just didn't follow this, basically. Let's have a listen to one of the records that is notorious for being one of those that Herc liked to play, and in particular liked to isolate the break from. And this is the incredible Bongo Band's Apache.
Yeah, well, it's always interesting to hear that and think about the fact that in the 90s in particular, because of the emergence of jungle drum and bass, there's this incredible interest in the history of the breakbeat. And there's a whole sort of school of thinking about contemporary music in the 90s, which really understands the breakbeat, beginning with James Brown in the thinking of most of those commentators, as being the thing that defines modern music, the thing that defines a particular musical tradition that runs from James Brown through to drum and bass and instrumental hip hop and other kinds of electronic music in the 90s. And this idea that it is somehow the key event of musical history of the late 20th century, the isolation of the breakbeat, the isolation of this small percussive unit from which other things can be reconstructed. It's an interesting idea. And I think a lot of the people who were making those arguments in the 90s would now probably say that it was overstated, at least insofar as it was an approach which sometimes indeed dismissed to disco and house, and at its most extreme wanted to argue that the four to the floor beat and the continuous beat, the continuous smooth beat mix, were sort of fascist in their implications. But it's really interesting to think about how important this would become, at least for some people and some musicians and some artists and critics.
Yeah, I'm just remembering, actually. I mean, no, that's, you're absolutely right. And I mean, I think it's the breakbeat. The break does have this, it has this incredible role, and it's something which goes back to, you know, early, you know, jazz music. So David liked to play, actually, I'm just remembering now, Benny Goodman's Swing, Swing, Swing. We could have a quick listen to the break in Swing, Swing, Swing. And, you know, somewhat bizarrely, I'm not trying to make that case that David was a breakbeat DJ, of course, but I have been digging out these old interviews with David, and he said, we all like to, this is not a direct quote, I know I started to say it as if it was, I have got the quote in front of me, actually, so why don't I read it? I mean, basically, it's about Dennis Coffey's Scorpio. Yeah, he said, I only ever made a transition in the middle of a record with Scorpio by Dennis Coffey, because it had a drum break that was incredible. Before the drum break would end, I would start the drum break on the other 45, so I'd extend the drum break. We all extended the drum break on that record. So even David Mancuso was fucking well mixing between the breaks on some level. It's ridiculous, isn't it? So there we are. That's quite funny. Let's have a listen to that break in Dennis Coffey's Scorpio, just to kind of, you know, because it's great and because it's kind of, on some level, it's amusing to think of David mixing between records as well.
Okay, well, we've talked about the break beat, and the next thing to be talking about is break dancing, but we're going to do that in the next episode so that we don't end up dragging this one out longer than necessary. So, well, thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Jim.
And bye-bye.
Bye-bye.